This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. This week's episode is brought to you in part by KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids of all ages that makes learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math fun. Inspire creative confidence this year with KiwiCo. KiwiCo is offering Science Magazine podcast listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more, visit kiwico.com/magazine. That's kiwico.com/magazine. Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 8, 2019. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, I talk with contributing correspondent Lizzie Wade about new evidence that the same Black Death that devastated Europe in the 14th century also swung down and hit sub-Saharan Africa. And Megan Cantwell talks with Gustavo Pilates about evidence for humans hunting and butchering giant ground sloths more than 12,000 years ago in Argentina. Now we have contributing correspondent Lizzie Wade to talk to us about a completely different story than we discussed last week. This time we're going to talk about the extent of the medieval plague. Most of us know about the Black Death in Europe, but turns out the plague might have gone a lot further than researchers had thought. Hi, Lizzie.
Hi, Sarah.
What has up until now been the accepted extent of this plague during the 14th century?
So most of us know about the Black Death from these mass graves in London, and it really affected all of Eurasia, extending from at least Russia over to the British Isles and down to Egypt and North Africa and around the Mediterranean world. But once it gets to Africa, it encounters this big environmental barrier, which is the Sahara Desert, which is obviously a very extreme and trying climate. And since the plague travels in fleas infesting rodent populations, historians had just sort of assumed that it hadn't made it across the Sahara Desert, that it was too hard. Thus, the societies in sub-Saharan Africa had been spared this tragedy.
Right. There was even some archaeology or lack of archaeology that backed that up, right? There was no written record of this plague hitting sub-Saharan Africa during that time.
Yeah, there are very few mentions of diseases. There are very few written records from medieval sub-Saharan Africa to begin with, although there are some. Some of them have some kind of vague mentions of epidemic diseases, but that doesn't really tell you what microbe is causing them, right? And these plague pits haven't been discovered. The big advance recently, of course, in the study of the Black Death in Europe has been ancient DNA. And you can actually find the DNA of the microorganism that causes plague in the skeletal remains of people who died from it. And that hasn't been found in Africa so far.
I was going to say, what is the new evidence? Why are we talking about whether or not the plague made its way across the Sahara?
Some historians and archaeologists have just been rethinking this a little bit. Sub-Saharan Africa in particular has been envisioned as disconnected from the rest of the world during this period, this medieval period. European traders weren't going there yet. People just thought it was off on its own doing its own thing, which is kind of a colonial way of looking at things. And people are sort of reevaluating the story about how Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, was connected to the rest of the world and finding lots of links through trade and other ways. And so plague came up as one of these possible ways, because in the 14th century, this is the late 1300s, just as the plague is striking London and all these medieval European cities, there's also this big change in many sub-Saharan African societies. A lot of sites are abandoned and sort of never returned to. Some sites are abandoned temporarily. Some sites really shrink fast in size. And in some areas, there's like some political changes. In other areas, there's environmental changes. But this thing seems to happen in a lot of societies that cross a lot of those boundaries. So archaeologists started saying, like, what is going on here? Could it be connected to what's going on in Europe at exactly the same time?
What were some of these locations that were abandoned? How disparate are we talking here?
So most of the archaeology so far, and this is a new idea, so it will continue to be explored, are in Ghana and in Nigeria. There are sites that are abandoned. There's a site in Ghana called Akrokroa. I'm not quite sure if I'm saying that right. It's called an earthwork site, this farming settlement surrounded by a big ditch and kind of banks to mark the settlement's boundaries. That one and dozens of other earthwork settlements that have been identified in southern Ghana at that time, they thrived for hundreds of years before being really suddenly abandoned in the late 1300s. There's a site, quite well-known site in Nigeria called Ife, that's sort of considered to be the historical homeland of the Yoruba ethnic group. So like really important for Nigerian history. And there's some evidence there that there was a rapid abandonment in the 14th century. And then people eventually came back, unlike to Akrokora. And there's a site in Burkina Faso called Kirikongo that wasn't actually fully abandoned, but after growing for 1,000 years and like doing really well and having like all sorts of interesting things happen to it, it just shrinks suddenly in half. It is cut in half in the span of decades or maybe even years. In a lot of these places, you don't see it coming. There's no evidence of invasion or increased conflict. They seem to be doing just fine, living the way that they always had. And then suddenly something changes for the much worse.
And you mentioned in your story that this pattern in the archaeological record matches what happened during the Justinian Plague.
Yeah. So plague is one of the few diseases that kills enough people fast enough to really leave a mark in the archaeological record. Even something like Ebola today would not spread this fast or kill this many people in the past if something like that had emerged. And the reason that the Justinian plague is a particularly good comparison for archaeologists, I think, is because at this point in the British Isles, you also have a real dearth of written records. There's some monks saying, like, my abbot died in this pandemic or whatever, or epidemic. But like they're not very specific. Not a lot of people are writing. Unlike when the Black Death hits centuries later, that's much more well documented historically. So, you know, with this Justinian plague in the British Isles, you just have the archaeological evidence to go on. And it does look pretty similar to what's happening in Africa.
So you mentioned there was no ancient DNA evidence, but there is some modern DNA evidence that the plague did travel to Africa.
Yeah, precisely. So there is no ancient DNA, plague DNA from sub-Saharan Africa, and sub-Saharan Africa is not a great place for DNA preservation. People really have to look very hard and have a lot of luck. But there is sort of a very evocative hint in a strain of plague that's endemic currently in Central and East Africa, mostly kind of in the highlands. It will like hang out in rodent populations and then emerge periodically to kill people. This strain of plague is really, really old. And it seems to be based on ancient DNA evidence from Europe and actually from Russia. It's descended from a strain that was killing people in Russia during the 14th century. So like that shows that this plague strain eventually made it to Africa. They're still not quite sure when. This is probably not the strain that was killing the people in West Africa that we just talked about. But it does seem to enter a lot earlier than many, many historians and other people who think about disease always thought.
Is there any theory about how it would have traveled during that time period? Were there routes that have been suggested?
Sure. Yeah. There are like tons of trade routes that connect Eurasia and Africa and really the rest of what people call the old world at this time. There's like a really thriving Indian Ocean trade that's bringing goods and people and presumably diseases all between the Middle East, India, Southeast Asia, Africa, East Africa. There's very extensive trans-Saharan trade routes. These are like things that are quite well known. It's just like nobody had thought that the plague could have traveled this way.
Well, what about one other line of evidence that you mentioned? I think it's in your story. I know that it was part of the search for visuals to go with this piece. These saints that are showing up in Ethiopia that are associated with the plague in Europe. How did that happen? Does anyone know?
Nobody really knows yet. The two sort of key saints here are called Saint Roch and Saint Sebastian. Their association with plague is a little bit folkloric and piecemeal, but lots of European plague victims and sufferers and people just worried about it were praying to these saints kind of during the 15th century, maybe a little earlier. And at some point, Ethiopians start praying to them too. Why the sudden interest at the same time that this Black Death strain is potentially arriving, that these saints would also arrive like that? That's pretty evocative.
Besides just looking for that ancient DNA, that this is the bacteria we're looking for in a skeleton from the exact time that we want, is there anything else that researchers are going to be looking for to try to tighten up this theory?
Ancient DNA would really be the silver bullet that would clinch this case. It would be undeniable that plague was causing these societal changes in medieval sub-Saharan Africa. In the meantime, what archaeologists are trying to do is to see how plague might have affected these societies. So like there's this 14th century event, whether that's plague or something else that they don't know yet. Clearly, there's some kind of before and after. And what archaeologists are starting to do, even in the absence of this conclusive DNA proof that it was plague, is starting to explore exactly what the effect was on these societies. What did these societies look like after this, what appears to be quite a traumatic event?
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lizzie.
Thank you, Sarah.
Lizzie Wade is a contributing correspondent for Science. You can find a link to her story at sciencemag.org/podcasts. Stay tuned for Megan Cantwell's interview with Gustavo Politis about evidence for humans hunting and butchering giant ground sloths. This week's episode is brought to you in part by KiwiCo. KiwiCo creates super cool hands-on projects for kids that makes learning about STEAM fun. With a KiwiCo subscription, each month, the kid in your life, be it your own kid, your neighbor's kid, your niece or nephew, grandkids, will receive a fun, engaging new project, which will help develop their creativity and confidence. The projects are designed to spark tinkering and learning in kids of all ages. There are 7 different types of crates to choose from. You've got tadpole crate for infants, koala crate for naturally curious preschoolers, all the way up to the Eureka crate, and that's for me, you, and anyone else over 14. KiwiCo's mission is to empower kids, not just to make a project, but to make a difference. Everything is created by KiwiCo's team of in-house product designers and rigorously tested by kids, which means they can do it and they won't break it before it's done. Every crate includes the supplies needed for that month's project, easy-to-follow instructions, and an educational magazine to learn more about that crate's theme. KiwiCo is offering Science Magazine podcast listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more, visit kiwico.com/magazine. That's KIWICO.com/magazine.
Towards the end of the Pleistocene, the time span about 2.5 million years ago to 12,000 years ago, large animals known as megafauna started disappearing by the masses. Some suspect that the introduction of a new predator, humans, contributed to this extinction event, but that the Pampas region of Argentina might have provided a refuge for these mega mammals. I'm here with Gustavo Politis to talk about new evidence of exactly when these megafauna started disappearing in the Pampas region. Hey, Gustavo, thanks for joining me.
How you doing, Megan? Thanks for calling.
Yeah, of course. To start out with, could you describe what some of these giant megafauna looked like that went extinct during the Pleistocene?
Well, this megafauna was very common in the Pampas of Argentina during the Pleistocene. I am talking, for example, about the giant ground sloth, which weighed about 4 tons. I'm talking about the glyptodons, right? This giant armadillo, which weighed about 2 or 3 tons. We have also mastodons, 3-4 tons, like the contemporary elephants. Actually, it seems that South America lost at least between 40 to 50 genera of different species, and most of them very, very big animals.
Yeah, it's a staggering amount that's lost. Why do researchers think that humans played a role in this extinction?
Well, because some of this fauna, like the giant granite sloth of the glyptodont, suffered climatic changes along millions of years, and they were able to survive and to recreate new species, right, in order to adapt to these new environmental conditions during the Pleistocene and the Pliocene. But at the very end of the Pleistocene, there were other predators, humans, right? It was a new species in the continent, in America. So we do not know exactly how the humans impact these mega mammals, but we do know that they had some influence. That we are trying to do right now is trying to understand, to have a better knowledge about until which extent humans collaborate, help in the extinction of these mega mammals.
Besides humans, what other factors could have contributed to the extinction of these megafauna?
The other thing, some researchers think that some of parasites or some disruption in the environment brought by humans could also affect the megafauna. Not just the direct hunting of the animals, but also some kind of secondary changes that humans produce in the environment.
Your research centered specifically in the Pampas region. Why did some people suspect that this might have been a place of refuge for these giant animals? What about the area is so special?
Well, some of these people is myself, right? I suspected that before. So I am the first one to be contradicted with the new research. So we thought that because of the Pampas is a very extensive grassland with a very high productivity, a kind of paradise for these mega herbivores, it might be the case that this environment would act as a refuge for these mega mammals during the late Pleistocene Holocene. Also considering that the hunting pressure from the indigenous people was probably not very high. So we imagined in the past in a scenario where people and Pleistocene megafauna were coexisting in the Pampas for several millennia.
What did you discover that's changing this line of reasoning now?
Well, we re-excavated this site called Campo Laborde, where we found clear evidence of the hunting of a giant granite sloth. We have several knives associated with bones of this giant granite sloth, the Megatherium. We had dated these bones, and we got dates between 7 to 9,000 before present. But the content of collagen, you know, the organic part of the bone, which is the datable material, was very low. And the deposit, the archaeological deposit, was below an stratum with very high organic contents. So now with Dr. Thomas Stafford and Dr. Emily Lindsay, they develop new and very sophisticated methodology to pre-treat the samples in order to separate what is really collagen from the bone and what is other substance like humic acid coming from these inorganic sediments above the layer, which would contaminate the sample.
So you're saying the previous samples that you took were contaminated and that the radiocarbon dates weren't as accurate as they could be, which was giving you that other range of dates.
Yes, you got the point, Megan. We are saying that because of the low content of collagen that this sample had due to diagenetic process, very common in the Pampas, the previous radiocarbon date probably dated collagen plus humic and fulvic acid. And if that happened in this site, we suspect that the same would happen in the other site, which produced early Holocene dates.
So now your new dates are saying that these megafauna did not persist in the Holocene since they didn't make it to 12,000 years before now.
Exactly. We are saying that given the fact that we have this accurate and precise radiocarbon date, we suspect about the other early Holocene dates in the Pampas. And if that happened, then the time of coexistence between humans and megafauna reduced a lot, reduced to 1 to 2,000 years instead of 5 to 6,000 years, right? The time span gets shorter. In that case, it's increased the possibility that humans actually had some impact, right? Some influence in the extinctions of these Pleistocene fauna.
Is there a chance that there are any other Pleistocene megafauna that could have persisted into the Holocene, or do you not see any evidence of that given this new way of dating?
I think that there is one animal, which is called the Eutatus sigini, which is a big armadillo, but not very big, but is bigger than a current contemporary armadillo. And this animal, which weighed about 50, 60, or 70 kilos, is a chance that this armadillo survived. But in regards to the big animals, like giant granite sloth or glyptodons...
Right, the really big ones.
Yeah, the really big ones, the one who weighed more than 1 ton, we are very suspicious about that possibility. But again, Megan, I have to say that we have to redate all the other sites now, right, with this new methodology, because we are suspecting that these samples were contaminated, but we cannot be completely sure until we perform a series of new radiocarbon dates following the same methodology.
So with this armadillo, was it not hunted by people? Is that a reason that it could have persisted?
No, it was hunted by people, but because of the smaller size, it has a more high reproductivity rates. So maybe it was hunted, but because of a high reproductivity rate compared with the glyptodons, for example, it seemed that it was probably able to survive. And also maybe it was more flexible to the climatic change.
The next step with your research is redating some of these samples that you took from study sites in the past. Is there also other areas that you want to look into?
Yes. I mean, we are trying to re-excavate some of the sites. It seems that the Pampas is one of the best places to test this hypothesis because we have an extended grassland, good preservation, and a huge variety of displaced Pleistocene megamammals, much more, for example, than in Patagonia, where you have very good preservation of bone in the caves, right? But the variety of megamammals at the end of the Pleistocene was less. But let me tell you, Megan, I'm very suspicious about older sites in South America, right? I think that between 15,000 years before present, there is not a solid evidence of human presence in South America, at least.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Megan.
Gustavo Politis is a professor of archaeology at the Universidad Nacional del Centro and University La Plata in Buenos Aires, Argentina. You can find a link to his research at sciencemag.org/podcasts.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify even, or you can listen to us on the Science site. That's sciencemag.org/podcasts. To publish an ad on the Science Podcast, contact midroll.com. The show is produced by myself, Sarah Crespi, and Megan Cantwell, and edited by Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.
This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.